We'll interrupt. Okay. So, continue our conversation with Derek DeKirchhoff. He requested interrupting the inventory of Barrington Nevitt's 10-point program, written in 1980, to go into another part of the section, Barrington Nevitt's section, on this long essay called Literate Aesthetic Cliché Probes in the American Classroom Without Walls that I did 12 years ago. So, Derek, go into what you want to raise.
Well, I was interested in the classification of different types of sciences that Barry had put together.
Right.
You know, the old Scienza Nova.
Now, let's do this. Yeah. You're going to read. There's this, about five or six kinds, and it's very complicated. So do you want to read through each one, talk, or do all five first? Five or six.
No, whatever. I can. Well, the first one is Vico's.
Right.
And it's the one that deals with Vico's three eras and the invention of language, God, heroes, and men of ancient historical and mythical times.
Well, let me read what he says. Barry says, in retrospect, the old Scienza Nova of 18th century Vico was concerned with discovering the mainsprings of human thought, feeling, and action in his own day through the languages of, quote, gods, heroes, and men, unquote, of ancient historical and mythical times. That's the old Scienza Nova.
Yes.
Then the next one is?
The old Science Nouvelle, which is the French philosophe. Of 18th century philosophe thought to explain thinking and being in terms of old Democritan atoms and void and the dominant mechanical metaphors of their day, with the yes or no logic still dominant in our day. Its ideal was to separate thought from feeling literally, which is...
In italics. Those two little asterisks means it's italicized by him in his book.
Probably to bring in the effect of literate forms.
Yes, he's trying to make you aware that it's writing. It's print.
It is. No. It is, and clearly, the yes or no logic that is still dominant in our day, that's the interesting part, because it is now... It's pushed to the extreme, so it becomes its reversal in some ways.
Right. Now, is that your Cartesian? Yes or no logic? That's not Cartesian?
No, Cartesian is certainly... Yeah, no, there is certainly in the yes or no logic an absolute Cartesian stance.
Okay.
But
this is a couple hundred years later or so.
That's right. And I think that... What I find interesting is this idea that if you push the yes or no logic to its extreme at multiple, at the infinite instant speed, the speed of light, you reverse its binary system to become very comprehensive.
All right. Before you do that, he says in this section, 18th century, the philosophes, which was a category philosopher, the time of the French Revolution, he says the dominant mechanical metaphors of the day. So, as we said the other day, kinetic space is happening, industrial space, pulleys and levers, and that may be a bit of the update of the philosophes from pure Cartesianism. See what I'm saying? It's a little later.
No, I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. No, I'm not, I think he's just making the point. He's stating that particular layer of what we call science.
Right.
Then the old new science, the interesting thing is that the more interesting part in the third one is the old new science of 19th century Marxism.
Okay, before you go into that, he uses Italian in the first one for Vico, Scienza Nuova. Was that Italian or Latin? Maybe it's Latin, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then the second one...
Italian. It's Italian.
It's Italian. Then the second one of the philosophes of the 18th century, he uses French, Science Nouvelle. Then the third category is English, the old new science.
Mm-hmm.
Always meaning new science. Okay,
right.
You want to read that one?
The old new science of 19th century Marxists revived the Heraclitian yes and no dialectic in Hegelian concepts minus percepts by treating all order as visual order.
Visual in quotes, as visual order.
And divorcing thought from feeling objectively.
That would be italicized, sort of drawing attention to the form.
Now, this is the Hegelian concept minus percept. is very interesting, because Hegel could not have missed percepts. I think that he may have expressed, you know, dialectic and its outcome in what seems to be a conceptual form, but to actually imagine it or actually synthesize, integrate it, he had to have perceived it.
Okay, where the important clarification here is that when McLuhan wrote a foreword to the reprint of Empire and Communication, I think that in his book, if not the, he did the Bias of Communication in 64, so I think this was another Innes book. And in the preface or foreword, 1972, he begins by pointing out that Hegel saw existence, but as a concept, and missed the ground. And this is really important because many people, even William Roman Thompson, told me that McLuhan was Hegelian. No, you have to include the technical grounds that McLuhan did to get past Hegel. Because you were saying that Hegel, yes, seemed to be talking percept, trying to, but he conceptualized it. It was a new concept or a new retrieval. Would you agree?
Yes, I would. And that's actually a very good point.
I think it's key point to understand, and it's great that McLuhan did write it. You know, late in his life, he made that point. He probably knew about the Hegelian projection on him. And he says, I don't know if I have it exactly, I might be able to find it later. He says, Hegel was looking at existence, but it was as a concept, not looking at ground as technical percept. You see, just the idea of ground was just striking Hegel. He was getting past concepts, right?
What would be interesting is there would be also an explanation for Marshall's antipathy to Théâtre de Chardin.
Yes, yeah, that's really important. You know, Tom Wolfe makes a big deal out of de Chardin in his documentary he did with Stephanie McLuhan. And that's not going to get you to see the real vision of McLuhan, the real breakthrough.
You know what? I had a talk about Théâtre de Chardin with both Marshall and, what's his name, Girard?
Who would that be?
He was a famous, wait a minute, not Girard, it's coming back to me. Famous Catholic priest, in fact.
Oh, Gilson?
Gilson.
Yeah, who was right next door to him, or used to
That's
be.
That's right.
Yeah.
And Gilson and I talked about Théâtre de Chardin, and Gilson said to me, oh yeah, that's like Les Malheurs de Sophie. And that's the story that kids read when they're, you know, a story of a good little bad girl, you know,
that
kids read when they're eight or so.
Yeah.
And so he called, oh, yeah, that's the misfortunes of Sophie. So that wasn't very nice. And Marshall just, I asked Marshall.
And was Gilson with Marshall when you asked Gilson?
No.
Oh.
But it was around that time that I also asked Marshall's opinion, and Marshall said, that's all science fiction.
Right, which he has said that he had written that somewhere, maybe even in Gutenberg Galaxy, I'm not sure. But he had used those categories, science fiction.
Anyway, so the point is that the whole Hegelian business is
the same thing.
I think it's on Marshall's mind in a similar way to the issue of how do you call that? Not cognitivism. No. I can't remember the word. That's a real pain because Marshall hated it.
You mean participation mystique or what
yeah,
word?
No. Well, I don't think he hated participation mystique.
No.
What he did not like, agnosticism.
Yes. And he didn't like the idea of the collective unconscious.
I also.
Right. So you're trying to think of some Gnostic word.
No. It's just agnostic. He just couldn't stand an agnostic type of thing. Anyway, so we can move on, but I just wanted to have
right here. First of all, sidetrack. Gnosticism. You know what that is? That's the effect of the phonetic alphabet, but certain kind of perverse human trying to retrieve acoustic space under the new visual effect. That's the Hellenic period, you know, just after Plato and Socrates, when Gnosticism is beginning to be rampant in to the point St. Augustine has to deal with it later. The Gnosticism is the abstraction that's caused by the phonetic alphabet that leads to St. Augustine's concept of the individual soul. That's the third term, Croker calls it. Resolves the ancient dialectical antinomies that the classical Greek era couldn't resolve. But once you had visual space, a visual billiard ball or a psyche or a soul...
You're just a... Wait. You're sounding just like Nevitt.
We're going too far.
You know, and I was, as I was waiting for your call, I was reading two or three sentences by Nevitt, and I swear to God, I couldn't do it, but I tried. I wanted to imitate his way of saying it.
And I did it. You couldn't, I did it.
Right on.
Well, that's true, yes. And my writing has been called drivel, and when it goes... when it goes Nevitesque. Okay, but let me try to make that simpler. Steve, do you know that Croker writes in the Postmodern Scene, he has a long essay on St. Augustine and how he resolved the endless chicken and egg antinomies that abstract thinking brought into Greek culture, the phonetic alphabet. It started to get abstract, and it couldn't figure out how to resolve any issue. You know, you get into the Heraclitian or the Zeno's paradoxes and that. So he said, by the time of St. Augustine, you have 400 or 500 visual space starting. The effect on the brain, the abstraction, brought up the notion that there was an individual soul. The beginning of the visual space artifact that really comes in with the printing press. Do you follow that?
Yeah.
Okay, so then he makes that the resolution, Croker calls it the third term. He resolves the classical antinomies and solves everything conceptually.
Yeah.
Well, the Gnostics, they are like people who have a strong acoustic sense or still have a tribal sensibility, and they want to take that abstraction and bring it back into mystical participation through a drug or something. You get what I'm saying? They are trying to retrieve. So they make the whole world seem evil. It's all fallen. But they want to go into some merger with some collective tribalness as opposed to rising above it all that Augustine recommends. I mean, do you get the difference I'm making? That's my theory about what Gnosticism is. It's the effect of the alphabet, but it's the attempt to retrieve the pre-alphabetic condition. And so it says that the whole world has fallen. It means we don't like this visual space effect. They don't know the causes, but they're feeling it. We want to retrieve some kind of personal participation mystique.
Yeah, okay. No, it's maybe the ends of Gnosticism escaped me, and that's why I had not interpreted it this way. But what you're saying makes actually very, very good sense. It's perfectly plausible.
Right. So the battle between the Gnostics and the Thomists is over where to go with visual space.
Mm-hmm.
So the printing press, remember the great retrieval of Gnosticism and mysticism at the time of the Renaissance and the Royal Society, and Francis Yates writes a lot about it. The Rosicrucianism comes into science at that point. That's the last gasp of Gnosticism, because the phonetic effect of the printing press favors the individual billiard ball consciousness, which then becomes Newtonian. Do you see what I mean? That's why you could say the church wins out conceptually over the Gnostics and maintains the establishment position. It favors the individualization that the printing press does, that the phonetic alphabet couldn't do as extremely, therefore you still had room for the Gnostic retrieval.
I see.
Okay, but it's important to say this Tire de Chardin is the same thing that Marshall's saying about Hegel. De Chardin is conceptualizing the global village, the global theater, the global membrane. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that the problem? Why he calls it science fiction?
Well, yeah. The fact that they are putting them into a theory makes it
the
makes
newest
it very
theory.
Different from what Marshall would do, calling it.
Yeah,
Marshall uses a poetic language as opposed to academic or scientific one.
Okay, the Tire de Chardin is projecting a future merger, a great condition, a noosphere, and Marshall says, that happened with the telegraph. You need to do, Mr. de Chardin, you got to deal with the increasing fragmentation and anti-merger that's going to come with the later technologies, the later electronic and digital technologies. That's what Tire de Chardin doesn't see. He's still talking and hypnotized by the merger effect, called the noosphere. Do you see what I mean? Because he doesn't see the technical ground that causes it. And so science fiction is celebrating effects of technologies coming without looking at the disservices and the tetrad factors. That's why science fiction is a literary, one-dimensional view of things. Oh, wow, look what society would be if we have this. And it changes it from where we are today. But
well,
if we,
what are, no, no, just give me a lineup of the disservice.
Of the telegraph, radio, television, and the digital. We've just had the most violent 150 years that we know. It's very hard to reconcile the literate Gutenberg effect or even the kinetic effect with the implosion or what I call the global membrane that comes in with the digital reality.
Agreed, but I think in fact it is now, we've gone through the worst of it, I think, the two world wars, and no, I think we're gaining in some kind of order now. We're developing an ethic that is global, and...
Well, that would be for the old industrial Gutenberg hierarchy. They're getting their act together. But they're up against the extreme super-angelization of Web 2.0, which makes people not even care about whether there's global peace or not, or global ecology, global balance. That's the disservice of connected intelligence.
I have to mull over that one.
Okay, we'll put that on the record. We'll get back to that because that is an important question because you're saying, no, it looks like something is, quote, mellowing out here. But
no, not mellowing out, shaping itself.
Shaping itself, all right. Okay,
and
so
I think we can't live without a new ethic, and I think more and more people are going to find that, and that new ethic will probably be a lot more respectful of the environment than it is today.
Well, do you remember when you did your first production that I know of for CBC, probably Ideas Network, in 1981 after Marshall passed?
Yeah.
You had this great excerpt, which we may have gotten from Peter Montgomery. I don't know where it came from. Maybe it was an Edwin Newman thing. It wasn't around from the Edwin Newman interview, but you had it and you played it. He says, women's live means women get total mobility and they will take over the old institutions. Now, that would be the institutions of peace and the industrial World Bank kind of stuff. But he says, what will men do? They'll go into total surveillance. Now, do you remember that quote? Really important. Women will take over the old domesticated bureaucracies. He even says in Cliched Archetype, he has a line, the hippies, the baby boomers, will be dedicated to peace. They'll be bureaucrats of peace. So you have women generally will take over those older institutions, while men will go into surveillance. And we have nothing but violence by surveillance. That's what Snowden is objecting to, because men can float discarnately and be super angels and fight with nations and corporations and hijack planets. That's the disservice of the digital membrane. And he said they would go into total surveillance. That, in other words, men would become invisible, and they'd just be monitoring. And we've seen, now he says that in 1980, and you see all through the 80s the rise of these paramilitary groups and spin-offs of intelligence agencies that are involved with surveilling what they think they're preserving, you know, the true America, they're against the United Nations, and becomes nothing but separatist groups like you have in Waco. And then it becomes extreme with Web 1.0, where everything is a conspiracy, right? That's men moving into surveillance, monitoring the news and saying the globalists are doing this and doing that. It's now commercialized by Alex Jones. So that's where McLuhan was right. What is a man going to do when the women can be multitaskers and can handle, at least from the old values, the bureaucracies better than men? They're even more videogenic on TV and all that. The men had nothing to do but to be surveillance of the information pattern recognition. Anyways, I've thought about that since 19...
A new relationship with drones.
Beg your pardon?
We are now in the era of drones.
Yes, and a great TV show that's caught up with that is dealing with is 24. Did you ever watch Jack Bauer and 24 at any point?
Good. It's called 24.
Oh, it's awesome. They do 24. They started back right after 9/11. They're now in their ninth episode with a four-year hiatus. But what they did, they started in late 2001, early 2002, where this the surveillance gang, the Patriot Bill people, I think they're called the CTU, they monitored everything. So So they are monitoring all the terrorism. So the whole show would be 24 episodes each season, and it would go for 24 hours. So each episode would be 1 hour. You see? You only want it. So you have this incredible crisis for 24 shows. And they went through a tremendous 8 years of 24-hour crises, each 24-hour thing taking 24 shows. Then they had a four-year hiatus, and they decided to start over again, probably because Kiefer Sutherland, he did this other show in between called Touch, which he bombed. So he had to retrieve his charismatic image because he did really well with this 24 show. So it just started a few weeks ago, 1st of May. And so they always dealt with the latest technologies. Most of the scenarios in the first episodes were paranoid scenarios that the Republican Party George Bush II would be justifying the Patriot Bill. And so many people thought the show was just Republican propaganda, George Bush II propaganda. But it turned out, no, it was satirical. In the long run, as the series went through its 8 years, it became... It showed the obsolescence of everything, every institution. Okay, so you have 4 years. So what are they going to do after a four-year break? They go into the drone thing. So that's the latest crisis, drones that get hijacked. So that's why I'm just digressing this. Yes, drones are the new surveillance.
Yep, they already are. Listen, man, I can't make it too long because I'm going to have to go have dinner with friends. So I'm going to go through two more of these, and then we can go back tomorrow.
All right, and what? So the droning, yes, is the major military. Now there are women in there now.
No. The point was that the drones are symbolic of the male society in surveillance.
Yes. Yeah. That's it. That's where the. Now we could say with Web 2.0, it caused an identity crisis for the world of surveillance, and so you have what Corker would call panic drone, panic surveillance is what's happened over the last 20 years. With even the surveillance sites, the surveillance meme that McLuhan predicted.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where your breakthrough is. That's where it's potential a better situation, even though it's pretty complex.
So the next one is the new science of 20th century utopians, which restores ancient Procrustean measures to replace people with machines or cyborgs. With two-bit computer wits that have already achieved deadly logical maturity. You explained that to me. I like that term, deadly logical maturity.
Right. So this is – so Barry's still talking about the new science. Now, I don't think any of the modern – well, I don't know who the utopians would be. I think he means any – the Zbigniew Brzezinski, any of the technocrats involved with NASA security, and maybe some of the general systems guys. But so – they didn't write a book called New Science, but he's saying the new science of 20th century utopians, they are bringing in Procrustean. That's basically 1984 stuff, right? It's an extreme. I forget what the god what that refers to. Procrustean. Do you know what that means? Ancient.
Or the inventor, I think. Let's go. I can go and check it. Keep going.
Yeah, check. Yeah, it's not the inventor. That's
No, I know the
famous guy who got his stomach chewed up. You know, he took on the gods. But maybe, okay, you check
Prometheus.
That.
But no, Prometheus was an inventor and a master technician, but he invented writing. That's the most important.
Okay, look up Procrustean while I talk a bit here. So what he's saying basically that the hardware machines, which then become digital, so you get the Terminators, that these cyborgs, organic robotoids, will replace people. So this is the complaint about, I don't know, neoconservatism or profit before people. The extreme expression of that is the heck with people. Bring in the two-bit computer wit. That's the yes-no. That have already achieved deadly logical maturity. They think better and faster than us in terms of logical maturity. Now we just totally give over to the... to the hardware machines, to the hardware environment.
I found Procrustean. It's somebody who makes you fit the system.
Oh, yeah.
Making the system fit you.
Now, that's visual space, the old, Gutenberg banking measures, banking, the idea. Now, the problem for Western man is we're built on visual space and individualism, so we support genetically almost, mimically due to the printing press, private property. So if everything has to be private property and I own this and you don't and you're Derek and I can't be Derek, all those visual ID things that Marshall always was competing with, if you keep that system going, that leads to a 1984 and then the replacement of humans because you must profit above people, right? So that's the projection, that's actually a dystopian projection. He's making the utopians become dystopians, Nevitt is here.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a cliche. Many people understand that, and that's what they're afraid of, right?
Yeah.
Now, that's the new science, but then the new Scienza Nuova, he goes back to Vico's Italian. Now, this is really important how this goes past the dystopians.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to read that one?
Yeah, the new Scienza Nuova of comprehensive understanding retrieves the yin-yang complementarity of the ancient Chinese sages and Greek Heraclitus with human maturity, in quotation marks, that savors the paradoxes of life itself, like Shakespeare at the dawn of Gutenberg. It seeks to achieve a new unity of thought and feeling, like Joyce has sinned again with the keys to given. By using all human wits and senses with their technological extensions comprehensively, as James Joyce put it in his multisensuous Finneganese, an artificial natural language that only an Irishman could have invented. To borrow and to burrow and to barrow, that's our crass, hairy, and ever-grim life till one final howdy-do bouncer master raps on the bell with a bone and his stinker stang behind him with the scepter and the hourglass. We may come touch and go from atoms and bits, but we are presurely destined to be odds without ends.
Page 455 of Phineas Wade.
It is very funny.
Right, now that's a huge Barry Nevitt sentence. Right?
I love that. No, 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 no. Wait a minute. Joyce has half of it, more, in fact.
Okay, but he puts it in there. Now, he has in brackets.
It's in there complete, and I think it's great because it is beautiful. It's the parody of Shakespeare's Macbeth, when Macbeth thinks about life.
Right, a parody on what Shakespeare's Macbeth thought of life in his day upon hearing of his wife's death, Act 5, Scene 5. Okay, back to this. So Barry is saying there's a way out of the Procrustean measures if you don't stay limited to visual space accounting and the books based on printing press identity. If you retrieve other cultural modalities, that would be all human wits and senses and their extensions, and modulate them comprehensively, which gets close to, you know, more bombs and more, let's bomb Venezuela with books to counter the radio effect, you know, the Fire Sign Theater joke. The new retrieves the yin-yang complementarity of ancient Chinese sages and Greek Heraclitus with human maturity as opposed to logical maturity. Now, what's interesting is that the Web 2.0 does shrink the Procrustean 1.0 Leviathan Internet. It makes everybody float over the whole Internet, whereas it wasn't so much in Emailia, to quote Phineas Wake, of the 90s when Web 1.0 was happening. The huge return to human scale, even though it's a virtual human scale, with leads to human maturity is possible with Web 2.0 and maybe Web 3.0. That's where your optimism comes in about stopping and going around the 1984 trend of Procrustean measures. You get what I'm saying?
Yes, I think so. I'm actually... I have been working on epistemology for a fair bit. I've always found it interesting.
On what? And, I didn't get what you said.
Working on epistemology, that is the science of how we know things.
Oh, epistemology. Okay, yes.
Epistemology. I can't speak English. So, for example, I've just spent a few hours with a collaborator, a writer, a Chinese woman who is working at the University of Chongqing, and we're writing a book together on comparing the cultural effects of Chinese versus alphabetic literacy. We're both interested in that. And the idea being not to say one is completely without, you know, connection with the other, but to say what are their correspondences? Where do they actually collaborate, so to speak?
Who or what collaborates?
The yin-yang or the sort of Chinese way of looking at things or making things or creating things and the Western ways. I mean, you know.
Yeah, well, this is what Barry's addressing here.
That's right. What I'm saying, I understand this fully, and I like the word, and as you point out, the logical versus the human maturity now makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
You know, it's true. The human maturity includes absolutely the yin and yang and all the relationship of all the forms of observations.
And also, this the yin yang, and then you have Western schizophrenia. You know, the Chinese, not so phoneticized, they take the polarity, duality of life and are tactile with it. It's a juicy interplay. The Western man, phoneticized, makes them really split, either or. The electronic digital or tactility squared that goes around the world in the last 100 years, that bypasses the division between the East and West because they both have to deal with this secondary tactility, not secondary orality of Walter Ong, secondary tactility, and there's room for overlapping there. Because, the Western balance, the Westerns are balanced off of their extreme visual polarity. They now get to see a bit of yin-yang complementarity, and the Chinese see a bit of the either-or, all because they're inside a living organic environment that tactilizes. So you have the schizophrenic effect of literacy, and then you bring in what I call the endomeme or the living digital environment. It replays the schizophrenia back to us, so you actually have quadriphenia. You have four aspects. So the yin-yang of the Chinese doesn't deal with the other doubleness that's a tactile interplay brought in by the digital Android meme. See, so that's why the Chinese have to loosen up on their cultural dogmatism about yin-yang, just as the West has to loosen up on its dogmatism about the either-or. You see? Follow what I'm saying there?
I do. Anyway, man, I got to run. Because my friends next, I'm in the countryside, and I have country fellows here, and they're expecting me at 8. And it is 8, and it takes me 5 minutes to get there. So I'm going to...
I just want to end the tape, and I want to mention something to you.